the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to a very special Halloween episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey. I'm here with a different co-host. Len is out trick-or-treating with his offspring, his spawn, his scion. So with me tonight, a man who's always in costume, Bitcoin Gandalf. What's going on, buddy?
Happy Halloween, Joey.
That's high quality stuff over there.
Yeah, this is like any other day for me. I'm just hanging in my outfit.
Fantastic. I love it. We got a lot to talk about. You've been around the world the last little while. We're going to get to that. We're going to talk some Bitcoin. We're going to talk some, you know, current events, news, all that good stuff. Almost no research for this show because our research team, like I said, is out getting candy. So let's talk about the sponsors before we start. ShakePay, best place for Canadians to buy and never sell Bitcoin. They got a bunch of stuff going on. Like always, they got shaking sats. You shake your phone every day. They funnel you a few Satoshis up to 1,000 sats a day. Can you believe they've never said wake and shake anywhere? As far as I can tell, they're not selling wake and shake merch. They're not selling any of that stuff, which is insane to me. I don't understand that. So they got that going on.
They should milk that more.
They won't do it. I've suggested it many times. They can have it. Okay. But they've never done it. Then they got, what else they got? They got Shake Paid, where you can spend off your CAD balance. They might just comp you the whole thing in Satoshis. Can't beat it. They got the new ShakePay Earn program where you earn Bitcoin on your CAD balance. Outstanding stuff. I think if you're in like one of the first few tranches, you're either at 8%, 7%, or 6% APY, which is dope. And then, of course, like they got normal sats back. If you spend off your CAD balance, they just give you 2% for the first 5,000, 1% after that. Great company. CBP is our promo code. We love them. We hope you give them a shot. And then Ledin is the other company. Those guys are doing all kinds of great stuff. One of the best places on the planet to use your Bitcoin as collateral for liquidity, for a mortgage, for a loan, whatever. They got tons of stuff going on there too. As I mentioned, the mortgages are huge now, not available everywhere, but soon enough, people are just going to be using their Bitcoin for collateral for mortgages because all of us have been scammed out of fiat in the last 10 years and no one's got enough money for a down payment these days. Then of course, they have the interest-bearing accounts, which Len and I both use. You should give it a shot, not financial advice, but of course, if you want to give it a shot, we think it's safe and they've been very transparent through all of these DeFi, lending, leverage, you know, asteroids hitting the planet all over the place in that space the last little while. And, you know, when it comes to safety and keeping your assets with a third party, it's not always the best bet. But Ledin, you know, with the proof of reserves, you got to like what they're doing there. So if you want to give them a shot, use our promo code. It's somewhere in the description. And yeah, if you got questions, let us know. Let Mario know. And we'll see if we can get those answered for you. So that's the sponsors out of the way, Gandalf. Someone
shout
in the chat
Mario.
Is saying
he's great.
Yeah, Mario, he is the best. I haven't talked to him in a while. He's busy probably doing better stuff than hanging out on the Bird app. People in the chat so far very kind about the costumes. This is not a choker. One, it's a bow tie, and I should have had some suspenders, but I don't have any. Gandalf, obviously always in costume. So anyway, we appreciate the commentary. Gandalf, do you have the price of Bitcoin in American dollars over there?
I can pull it up.
What good are you? Don't you watch the show? It's the first thing we do.
My VPN. It's 20,000 something. It's a stable coin, I thought.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is the stable coin.
In Canadian, it's 26,000 something. So there you go. Little different tonight. We're going to talk a little bit about the stuff that we normally do. We'll talk a little inflation. We'll talk a little global economy. We'll talk a little, you know. But I figured since we had Gandalf here, we should talk about some of the stuff you've been doing the last little while. Because Len and I, as everyone who listens and watches the show knows, we only hang out in the basement, man. I'm a basement Bitcoiner. I don't do anything. I lift weights and I hang out in this room alone while my cat meows at the door and my dog waits for his next walk. So you are not living that life, sir. You've been globetrotting all over the damn place. So let's get into that. Where you been at? What have you been doing?
Yeah, in the last 3 weeks, I've had the great pleasure of going to Bitcoin Amsterdam, the UK Bitcoin Collective Conference in Edinburgh, and I just came back from Lugano. Sometimes I have a mind blank because I've never been to Lugano or really even heard that much about Lugano. So when, like, people ask me where I've just been. I'm like, I can't remember it. But yeah, Lugano, Switzerland. It's in Switzerland. It's in the Italian part of Switzerland. Nice little town by a lake. Lovely. Very, very rich. I was going to tweet out, are there any poor people in Lugano? But I thought that was a bit inflammatory, so I didn't. But it's that kind of place. Like, very, really, really nice.
You totally could have. Okay, so let's start in Lugano, since you were amidst my paisans over there. What were you doing at that conference? What's the conference about? If you want to go into a little detail, that's fine. And then I want to talk a bit about your feelings on conferences at some point, because I got some strong feelings on conferences and the legitimacy of conferences as far as like helping Bitcoin. And I think maybe you and I might have a bit of a disagreement, although maybe I'll change my mind after hearing what these two were about. So start with Lugano. Give me the like the day-to-day rundown. What'd you get up to?
Yeah, so the conference in Lugano is part of the Plan B initiative, which is being led by the local Lugano city government and Tether. So if you follow Paolo Ardoino, the CTO of Tether, he's constantly tweeting about stuff to do with Lugano. And yeah, the conference was focused around freedom and Bitcoin. So Julian Assange's family was there. We had Nick Szabo doing a presentation on the history of money. It was Bitcoin stuff. So it was sort of had hints of the Oslo Freedom Forum, but much more focused on Bitcoin than freedom. So it was more like Bitcoin with elements of freedom. And for people that don't know, so there's a company called Hole Punch. There's an app called Keet, which is like a peer-to-peer messaging video chat app that's being developed. Paolo's involved in it as an investor. I think he might be the CSO or CTO or something. Anyway, there's a couple of people working on it, but Paolo is one of them. If you've seen the pair emojis around Twitter, like the pair-to-pair is supposed to mean peer-to-peer. And so that's just part of like Paolo's push right now is all about freedom, privacy, and like all of us being able to own our own data without having to share it with massive centralized big tech companies. So with Keet, we don't rely on a company to like store our messages on their server and relay what we say to each other back and forth. It's me directly connecting to you and chatting, sort of like I could download a file from you via BitTorrent, except it's text and video.
So, okay. I do want to talk about that because I didn't know about that. That sounds pretty cool. It sounds almost like Session. You have Session on your phone? You ever heard of that?
I've heard of all of these different types of like decentralized or peer-to-peer chat apps and all that. Matrix, I think, is one, Session, but I've never used any of them.
They're pretty cool. I would recommend trying that. I've never like had a need for it, but I've just fucked around with it a little bit with a couple of my buddies. It's not bad. Okay, so you said a couple of big names there at that conference. Szabo, obviously, one. So what was his masterclass, you said, that's they were calling it? It was like a sort of a, I guess, instructional thing or is talking about the history of Bitcoin. What was he all about?
Yeah, so the conference had like a main stage and then it also had masterclasses. So the masterclasses were done in these small rooms that could fit maybe about 100 people. And Nick Szabo gave a masterclass on the sort of the history of money pre-Bitcoin. So all the way from the start until Bitcoin. He's like his most famous piece of work besides BitGold is a blog post or an article he wrote called Shelling Out. I've got to admit, I've never read it, but it's about the history of money.
He's a guy that I would love to get on this program. I was telling you that. I think he would be hard to get. I was a little disappointed with...
I sent you his email.
I know. I should just use it. I should use it. But you know what I was thinking? After we talked about that, he did an appearance on McCormick's show a few years ago, right? And then I think after that appearance, him and McCormick had a falling out on Twitter, and I can't remember about what. Do you know what that was about?
Oh, interesting. No, I don't. I don't.
I cannot remember, and I wish I could. Because he seems like a guy who's not like super keen on public speaking, to be honest with you. And I don't know that much about the man. I know he's, you know, sort of legendary in this space, but you know, as far as like a podcast appearance, I'm not sure that he'd be interested in something like that. So, okay. Anyway, you were going to say something. What else you got?
No. Yeah. So I've only ever heard of him or seen him appear. I think it's only at the Bitcoin conference. He normally does a talk there. This was completely different. Like I got there 20 minutes before the talk started and I thought there's no chance I'm getting a seat in a 100-person masterclass. And it was quite full, but people were being a bit shy and not sitting on the front row. So I literally sat right in front of him. I got to shake his hand afterwards. And yeah, we got the 20 minutes early. He was already in there just, you know, standing at like the lectern or whatever you call it, for like 20 minutes preparing, I guess, setting up the computer and whatever. And then, yeah, towards the time when the masterclass was about to start, people started like piling in, and there's people complaining that how could you have Nick Szabo in such a small room? Like, get him. Some guy was like trying to, he's like, let's get them on the main stage. He's like, yeah, sure, buddy. We're just going to like kick off whoever's on the main stage and get Nick up there. He did speak on the main stage the next day. He was on a panel with Adam Back and Paolo on the origins of the cypherpunk movement. But yeah, it was interesting. And I haven't read like any of the the history of money books or like layered money or any of that. I just kind of know the talking points from podcasts and seeing tweets and stuff. So it was interesting to sit through Nick going through all of that.
So what was the best panel you saw? It sounds like maybe that one with Adam, Nick, and the Tether guy might have been sort of top of the bill. But if you got another one, I'd love to hear it. And so it's like, I feel like when people go to these conferences, it's almost like a music festival where everyone goes for the top acts, but invariably you see something on a side stage or a side whatever that really, you know, captures you in a way you weren't hoping for. So maybe if you have one you want to talk about that was like the big one that you enjoyed, but then maybe one you enjoyed more than you thought you would, let's take both.
So I don't actually go to the talks that much because my thing about conferences, I'm there to like talk to meet people and to meet Bitcoiners in real life. What, like, why would I use up my time watching something that I can watch back on 2x on YouTube when I get home? Like, so, because, you know, that's where the value is. You know, if I want to watch the Nick Szabo talk, okay, Nick Szabo in a 100-person room is a unique physical experience. So I did go to that. Because I thought it would, you know, it's like probably a once in a lifetime kind of thing to get to sit in a room with him. And I had a VIP pass. So I actually ended up like I had a VIP pass as like equivalent of being a speaker. So there was like a speaker's dinner, VIP pass dinner. And he was there. I was on a bus with him afterwards, like getting taken back to the hotel and stuff. It was interesting. But yeah, the panel, I did watch one panel in Amsterdam at Bitcoin Amsterdam. It was called Bitcoin's Media Problem, and it had two mainstream media journalists. One of them was Jemima Kelly, who writes a lot about Bitcoin for the Financial Times. Another one was an ex-Financial Times journalist, and then you had Pete Rizzo from Bitcoin Magazine and Joe Hall, Joe Nakamoto on Twitter from Cointelegraph, with Daniel Prince, the host of the Once Bitten podcast, moderating. And that was that was incredible because it wasn't just the same, you know this because you host a podcast and you have guests, and like very often the same guests just do the rounds on all the podcasts and they do all the talks, and you've heard their talking points a million times as well, right? So there's only so many times you can hear the same thing. This panel was amazing because when do you ever get like a no coiner like futster on stage at a Bitcoin conference? And you know how much these hit pieces on Bitcoin, how much attention they get on Twitter. Well, this was like that, but in real life. So, you must have seen clips, right?
I haven't seen anything yet. I've been so busy between work and stuff, but I haven't. I haven't seen anything. So
she became a meme because she said like so many times. Did you not see this?
Oh, I did see this meme, but I haven't seen the actual like the clip of it. I do want to watch some of this stuff because I find that, you know, these days, to your point, Gandalf, about like the people I want to hear are doing all the podcasts within a 2 or 3 week period. And I just can't listen to the same talking points over and over again. So I should try and get these conferences. The only downside is on YouTube, you can't really use YouTube as a podcast stream platform because I need my phone for other stuff. Like I can't sit there with my phone on YouTube for an hour and a half, whatever the case is. Although I'm not paying for that, bro. This operation is not lucrative enough yet for that. I refuse to give up the $15 a month.
You use a VPN and then you pretend you're in India and then you sign up to YouTube Premium India, which is way cheaper.
Is that true? That works?
Yeah, apparently. I don't do that, but yes, apparently it is cheaper in India, so you can do that.
Breaking news here on the CBP. Tell me about the atmosphere at these conferences. You said you don't go to a lot of the talks. I understand the rationale for why. I do see when it comes to these major gatherings, a lot of pictures on Twitter, people going out for dinner, people going out for drinks, enjoying each other's company, like you said, meeting Bitcoiners in person. Is the atmosphere really as jovial as I'm led to believe in some of these pictures of like long ass dinner tables with, you know, half drank bottles of wine? Or is it a little more guarded? I ask because, you know, you and I know each other, at least on the internet. And, you know, when you do public appearances, you still dress like that. I think a lot of Bitcoiners guard their OPSEC quite closely. And so those environments where people normally would let loose might not be so, you know, they might not be so conducive to that kind of behavior in a Bitcoining, in like a Bitcoin conference with a bunch of Bitcoiners at the table. So what is it like? Are people guarded? Are they jovial? Are they open with each other? What's your take?
I mean, my experience has been people have been very open, very jovial. I sat, I had dinner. I've already attended so many conferences, and then a lot of them have the same people. I've become quite close friends with a lot of people. So sometimes the conference is just about going back and like hanging out with your friends that you made at the last conference. I also work remotely for Brains, so I don't see my colleagues that much. So if a couple of us are going to a conference, that's like also us getting to talk about work stuff and getting to see each other in person. But yeah, I mean, I've developed close relationships with people, and they've been very open, and even people who like I meet for the first, or, you know, maybe I've like said hello to them a couple of times and hung out like in a group, and then we get to chatting one-on-one. Like, everyone's super nice and very open.
Yeah. Okay. So that was my next question. Is it, you know, because on Bitcoin Twitter, you see a lot of stuff about OPSEC, which is fine. Like, if people want to have good OPSEC, which I understand, and I think we should all strive for that. But yeah, I've always wondered that. The guys we talk to, you know, in the group chat, and I think a few other people that I talk to with some frequency on Twitter, are less concerned, let's say, about that sort of thing than they are about having a good time and meeting people and networking. So in that vein, who would you say I don't want to put you on the spot, Gandalf, but who's the person you enjoyed meeting the most at the conference in Lugano?
Trying to think of someone I met so I had met Natalie Brunel a couple of times before and hung out in a group with her, but in Lugano I got to spend like one-on-one. We were on a flight together, so we were at the airport together. I got to spend a little bit of one-on-one time with her, and she is amazing. She is such a nice woman, like incredible at what she does, loves Bitcoin, super nice, and you know, she's pretty high profile. You might think like she might turn her nose at you or whatever, but she's like nothing but kind to everyone she meets and works bloody hard. So I enjoyed spending some time with her. I can't think of anyone else that like I met for the first time that got to spend some time with Svetsky.
Hey,
this time around he was in my hotel. We had breakfast together one morning. I've spoken to him a few times. We've coincided at a few other conferences and stuff. But this was the first time, like, I sat down one-on-one with him, had breakfast, gave me a copy of his book. Yeah, he was awesome as well.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that, man. One thing I want to start doing next year, and I know Len and I talk about this with some frequency offline, is traveling to conferences. And it's a bit more difficult for him, you know, and potentially for you as well. You have a young daughter. So I think for me, I'm still not a family man, and I'm going to try to take advantage of that next year. Okay, so why don't we move from Lugano to the other conference you were at? I think maybe, was it a week before, something like that?
Yeah, I've done 3 in 3 weeks, literally.
Oh my God. Okay, so do you want to talk about all three? Can we talk about all three? Should we talk about all three?
I mean, they were all very similar. I didn't do anything like super exciting. I just met, you know, I hang out mostly like in the exhibition area. If there's an exhibition hall, there's stands, I'll hang out there. If like Lugano had a lot of outdoor areas and had like a tent, and it was right by the lake, so you could go out and to like sit by the waterfront, just hung out there. So yeah, it was just meeting people, talking to people, people DM you like that you've never, I met the guys from Relay app for the first time, even though like we've chatted on Twitter loads. I'd only met Samson, even though we worked together for a bit, once in person before. So I got to spend some time with him a little bit in Edinburgh, a bit more in Lugano. I met Prince Philip, the Prince of Serbia, in Amsterdam.
You did?
Yeah, we had a drink. Like, he was just at the hangout.
That's dope. I love that. Now you definitely make me jealous. Next year I'm going. I'm wearing a wizard costume too, just to have people confused.
I did free labor for Peter McCormack. I helped him and his kids load his car up with Rail Bedford stuff in the Edinburgh conference. I gave Peter McCormack a Coin Corner bulk card with £25 in it. And I can, because it's set up with my app, I can see whether he spent the money or not. He won't be watching this probably, but if he is, he's got 30 days to spend it. I'm going to sweep those bastards back.
Great. Okay. Well, listen, I appreciate you telling us about your conference globetrotting. Let's get into the normal content then of the show. So like I said, there's not a lot of research this week because without Len, to be honest with you, he does such a great job sweeping the news that I didn't bother trying to follow up that act. But I do want to talk about a few big stories, Gandalf. One of them is the continued blood in the mining space. We saw Core Scientific mid last week, completely fall apart. They're insolvent. Their operations are in big trouble. They're not paying their bills, according to a recent release. So you got that on one hand. And then today or yesterday, Argo also announcing that they're trying to restructure, refinance, rejig, re-whatever to try and keep their operation going. And we've talked about mining a lot on this show. And you know, you're obviously close to the mining space, closer than either Len or myself. And one of the things that I think we disagree on, Len and I, is what should mining companies be doing during bull markets to make sure they're not vulnerable during bear markets. And I am firmly in the camp now that the Bitcoin on the balance sheet play during bull markets is not a winning strategy. What they should be doing instead is trying to steel man their operations, so to speak, and try to influence legislation, try to do things that protect the price and maybe raise the floor of the Bitcoin price as well. And I know that there's some, you know, probably some thought that hodling plays a role in that. And that's true, I suppose. But, you know, I look at the return on investment that a lot of these companies who had Bitcoin in the balance sheet are getting at the moment. A lot of them have been able to maintain the balance sheet that they were heralded for a year ago. And in the worst cases, this is what we're seeing, you know, now with some of these miners. So what are your thoughts on the space at the moment? And a few specific thoughts on the company. Let's get into those too.
Yeah, I mean, this has been my first, I guess, bull to bear cycle. I came in what you could probably call, I first bought Bitcoin in what you'd probably still call a bear market in summer of 2019, although it was like a bounce back from whatever, the lows of 3K up to 10K. So, but what I've discovered is that a lot of the miners are just like degen leverage traders. So, you know, they're levering up in terms of like, well, they're diluting shareholders by selling equity at the top of the market. They're borrowing money at the top of the market. They're taking, yeah, and whether that's like Bitcoin back loans or ASIC back loans, they're holding all the Bitcoin they mine and not paying down any debt or, you know, selling any Bitcoin to have some dollars or hedge against the Bitcoin price. And so, yeah, of course, I think miners would be very successful if they listen to the old, like, be greedy when others are fearful and be fearful when others are greedy type thing. But the problem they have is that they're incentivized to take all this risk in the bull market. So the stock market, that's why their stock prices go up more than Bitcoin on the way up, because they're basically a leverage play on Bitcoin. So they're being incentivized to, there's cheap capital, so they borrow money at lots of money at low interest rates. There's demand for more equity in those companies, so they're willing to, you know, sell more shares or go public. They can take, you know, financiers are willing to give them loans, you know, ASIC back loans, for example. And then when the market tanks, you're basically left swimming naked. That's the saying, right? No, what is it? Yeah. When the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked.
Right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of shrinkage there probably for some of these guys. I don't know. Like Brains works, I don't want to say works closely with miners, because I think that's framing it incorrectly. A lot of miners use Brains OS, right?
Yeah, and they're our customers.
Yeah, right. So, you know, so let me ask you this. And this is another question that maybe is putting you on the spot, but since it's my show, I'm going to continue to do that. Do miners ever inquire about what they've, you know, what Brains thinks of the current state of the market? Given that you guys have been around a long time and you got a lot of smart people there, and it's a respected company with a long-term view, I would argue, it seems to me that there's not a lot of expertise at the industrial mining level on what to do during, I don't know, like, you know, if hash rate rips or drops consistently for a month, if price rips or drops consistently for a month or a quarter. It doesn't seem to me like there's a lot of strategy. The strategy, as far as I can tell, is buy, hold, tweet about it, and hope the stock price goes up. It's not a win.
And that's what was happening, though. So kudos to them.
I guess.
It's happening until it doesn't happen.
Exactly. And so, like, do they ever ask you guys, like, hey, in your opinion, or do you guys offer a service like that? I haven't really thought about this. It's coming to me now.
No. It seems to me like there's
for that.
I don't have visibility over like conversations with miners because I'm doing internal marketing work, but most of my role is dealing internally with the marketing team and coming up with content and whatever else. So I'm not customer facing in that sense. I'm not speaking to miners. That would be something that the business development team would be doing. But I would be very surprised if any person that's important in one of the big mining companies is asking us for what do we think about the market. I think
why those people, who are they asking?
I don't think they're asking anyone. I think they think they know, just like we all thought it was going to 100K. I think we were just all collectively drunk and so sure that we were going to 100K. Plan B's stock to flow model was hitting every month with his little like gifs of the sniper guy every month it hit, and we were all wasted going, "Woo!
I don't know what's next for industrial miners. I think the more I consider, you know, the investment thesis around industrial miners, and I had a guy named Mark Jeftovic on last week, very smart guy, good Canadian guy, who writes a it's not a blog, but he publishes a thing called Bomb Thrower, and part of Bomb Thrower is the crypto capitalist, and he's become the Bitcoin capitalist since then. And he writes a lot, I think, smartly on Bitcoin mining companies and sort of Bitcoin adjacent equities. And one of the cases he makes is that the Bitcoin in the balance sheet is sort of greater than NAV in a lot of these companies, or was during the last bear market. I don't know that that's going to be a strategy that works going forward. And the only reason I think that it's not going to work is because people, generally speaking, like people who are invested in the equity market, especially Bitcoiners who are invested in the equity market, I think they know better after one cycle like this, much the same way that Bitcoiners don't invest in, you know, NFTs after seeing CryptoKitties, much the same way that they don't invest in the next Ethereum killer after seeing, you know, cycle after cycle, some token come up and invariably drop off during the next bull market as, you know, capabilities change and this sort of thing. I wonder if you have a view on whether or not industrial miners as a equity position is a good idea long term. I don't know. I don't think you're a big investor, are you? We hardly ever talk about that, but I gather you're not.
I used to be before Bitcoin.
What do you think of the likelihood of those things being successful, like long term?
Yeah, I think you really have to know what you're. Like, I think you really have to understand that the mining industry to be able to pick a Bitcoin miner that's going to outperform Bitcoin and is going to outperform it, you know, enough that it's worth your time to spend all this time analyzing and watching over whether, you know, do they have the right people in place? Like, you have to have such deep and granular knowledge. Like, you should know, you know, who the VP of finance is or who the CEO is, like, met them, know their history. So I just don't see. For the majority of people, they're not going to be able to pick the winner. Like, we all thought, wasn't Core the biggest miner, or it's like the top three public miners at least?
Right? It was the biggest by hash rate. Miners.
Yeah, it was the biggest public miner by hash rate. And like they were saying they were going to get up to how much exahash? 30 exahash by the end of 2022 or something.
What are they going to be at by the end of 2022 now?
Could they have been more wrong about their hash rate estimate?
I don't know. And that's why, so that's why
they have 24 Bitcoin. So there's some plebs out there that have more Bitcoin on their balance sheet than Coz. And Coz is a Bitcoin mining company that mines like 1,000 Bitcoin a month.
How much did they sell over the last 6 months? 5,000, right? 5,000 to 10,000. It was a fucking ton.
Yeah. And they mine 1,000 something every month, don't they?
Yeah. Something
I mean,
like
they
that.
Just put up so that they do. Core operates a model where they have self-owned miners, and they also do hosting for other people, and they've just put up their hosting rates to 10 cents per kilowatt. So that means that anyone who's mining on their facility that is not mining, that is mining with anything other than an S19 XP, is now losing money. They're better off switching their miner off.
See, that's, to me, I think for an industrial miner, the calculation is different than for a home miner. This is obvious, I think, to a lot of people, but it just case it's not. You know, I would mine at home with an S9 at a loss, knowing that, first of all, I could throttle the compute power on the miner and make it closer to break even if I wanted to, mine only at certain times, et cetera, et cetera. Use something like Brains and try and get the most out of an old unit with the expectation that the price would be higher in the future. But my CapEx every month, my OpEx every month is zero, right? Like it's my mortgage and whatever my hydro bill ends up being. But for these guys, you know, they may feel the same way long-term about the price, but to run an operation of that size and to meet your fiduciary responsibilities to your shareholders, you have a different sort of set of operating values. And I think a lot of people don't get that. Now, one thing I don't understand, and maybe you can help me clear this up, is presumably they have eyes on how much they're losing per miner, right? Is that something they can see? They must be able to see that. And so I'm curious as to why they don't micromanage the operation a little more, or maybe they're not talking about it on the way down. Is that the problem? They're not talking about it on the way, like while the ship is sinking. It seems to me that these companies are going from, like Core is a great example, the best example we've ever had, top of the food chain to bankrupt in the blink of an eye. There's no press release, no indication, no nothing. Argo, different story, but Core, huge problem. And so I just wonder why they're not doing that.
You gotta remember that profitability in mining is dependent on sort of, let's say, three factors: power, like how much you're paying for electricity, the difficulty increment. So every time difficulty goes up, that's how much less profitable your mining operation is if you keep your hash rate the same. If you're not increasing your hash rate along with the overall increase in hash rate of the whole network, think about it like every time the difficulty goes up, your hash rate's being diluted. So you have less proportion of the overall hash rate. And so you're less profitable. You're mining less Bitcoin with the same machines as you were before the difficulty went up. And then we have Bitcoin price, right? And we've had a trifecta in a very short space of time of like Bitcoin price going from 69K or whatever it was in November last year to 40 something and 30 something. Oh, then it's okay. Luna's buying billions. So it went up to like 45. And then, oh no, Luna is actually full of retards and it was a scam anyway. So then it went down to like 20 and then, well, or whatever it was. And then basically you lost like 70% of the value of the thing you were mining, and that's your revenue, is gone. In the same time, hash rate is up like 50%. So your whatever you're left with mining is now also 50% less profitable. And you guys, we have energy crisis.
The energy crisis.
If you didn't fix your power, if you didn't fix your power prices, this will happen in a matter of months, and you're running a humongous industrial miner, it's very hard to adjust and save yourself from that. And and in the meantime, you're just like, okay, it's just only because like 3 hours sold loads of Bitcoin. It's going to go back up tomorrow, next week. Let's wait one. And then, you know, before you know it, you've waited 2 months, it hasn't turned around and you're bankrupt.
Do you think the power thing is going to be a major issue for a long time? Not necessarily that power is not going to play a part in the operation. Of course it is. That's a key pillar, as you mentioned. But I think there's a lot of these companies who are, they're juggling between like political stability on one hand and power procurement prices on the other hand, right? You can either operate in Texas and have a stable government, stable political ecosystem, all this stuff, and pay a little more for power. Or you can go to I don't know, pick your third world country, emerging market, whatever, go there for cheap power and probably be incentivized to open a business there by their government as well. But then you're also at risk of a guy, like I always say, with a chopped off Jeep driving by with a gold machine gun. And so yeah. I just wonder, like, are the miners and in turn, the network going to become less secure in their operation, in their security, in favor of cheap power, because the lesson they're learning, you know, whether it's the right one or the wrong one, I don't know. But the lesson they're learning is that we have to get the cheapest power possible because we can't control for the other stuff. Like, that's the one thing we can control for pretty steadily on our own, exclusive of everything else. We got to do that 100% of the time. And I know some companies like Bitfarms, Ben Gagnon, Smart Kid, he's probably my age, smart guy, talking about power procurement and how important it is to get renewables and cheap stuff and everything. And he's not the only miner talking about that. But I think there's a lot of companies who think they can get cheap power in America, Canada, whatever, Europe, and it's just not as cheap as they need it to be during prolonged downturns. So what do you think? You think there's a likelihood that they start risking the other two pillars in favor of the cheap power, even if it means third world stuff, or what?
Yeah, I mean, people have to weigh the trade-offs of the different options they have. I think, you know, in the past, they definitely wouldn't have risked moving a large portion of their operation to somewhere that's a little bit less politically stable, with, you know, perhaps like security or regulatory uncertainty. But now, you know, if you're in Texas, which is nice and safe and whatever else, but you're losing $50 million a month or $40 million a month or 30, it's like, well, you can keep going if you've got cash in the bank to make up for the losses that you're, well, the negative cash flow. You can switch off and just wait it out, fire everyone, switch off. But you probably have like an agreement that says you have to buy a certain amount of power from the power company in order to get the rates you're getting, right? Or you can dismantle your op and like try and find some rack space in Paraguay or something. Like, none of those are very good options. So I don't think anyone, I would assume that the miners that can make it through this are sort of looking to position themselves like, how can we stay where we are, you know, batten down the hatches, and this is going to pass, whether it's in 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. We all know what the cycles are like. And so they just know, you know, they have to survive a certain amount of time. Maybe they raise some. The miners that are in better shape, if they did need some more cash, they should be able to raise a bit of cash to tide them over. It's just these ones that are, you know, in dire straits, they're going to be fire selling. The people who have, you know, Jihan Wu, the one of the co-founders of Bitmain, who started a fund for distressed mining opportunities, he's going to rake it in. CZ 500, Binance has come out with the same thing with 500 million. He's going to rake it in. Anyone who's got cash available right now to buy miners, whether it's mining companies or the physical ASICs, they're going to rake it in. The people who bought S9s at the bottom of the market in 2020 or whenever they cost, you know, people were basically giving them away. They made more, if they had sold the S9 at the top, they would have made more money with the S9 than the Bitcoin in the same time period. Because S9s went from like 30, you could buy like a container of them for $30 each. And then they were 500 each at the top.
I want to get into mining. And the reason I want to get into it is because I want to learn a bit about it. But also, and this is, you know, lead into my next kind of question, discussion point here. I think that there's more tools available for the at-home miner than there ever has been before. Brains is the one that comes to mind for me, obviously, because, you know, I know you and I know the operation a little bit. Are you guys, like, do you guys see the number of people sort of adding your software to their machines moving as quickly up and to the right as the hash rate is? Is that a direct correlation? Or are you seeing people kind of come and go, miners come and go, major operations come and go, as far as the software they're using? What is the story there? I'm always curious because as someone who tries to follow hash rate and draw conclusions and make correlations between certain figures, I'm always wondering about that. Is the number of people running brains a good indication of hash rate about to go up or hash rate about to go down in the inverse scenario? Or am I completely off base there?
I would say hash rate is a leading indicator to what's going to happen to BrainsOS Plus usage for sure. Obviously, when it's a hot market, more people are mining, more people are using BrainsOS Plus. And by the way, I don't have visibility over how many people use BrainsOS Plus specifically, but I would bet that it's that the hash rate is a leading indicator. So obviously, the more hash rate's going up, the more miners are using BrainsOS Plus. And if you measure it in actual hash rate, you got to remember that each generation of machines is way more powerful than the last. Like the S19 J Pro is 10 times more powerful than the S9 in terms of hash rate. You get 10 or 13 terahash from an S9, and you get 100 from an S19 J Pro or an S19 Pro or whatever, and 150 from an S19 XP. So in terms of actual hash rate, every generation, you get a massive amount more hash rate come online. And Brains' business model is taking a fee of all the Bitcoin mined, so that obviously the higher the hash rate, yeah, that's on our machines, the more fee revenue we are receiving. Hash rate on BrainsOS Plus, there's a definite correlation with hash rate on the network. Now, you have to also remember that as new generation of machines come online, we have to then the devs have to work on support for those machines. So it's not just like BrainsOS Plus works on every miner, no matter what. Every time a new generation comes out, we have to develop develop support for those miners. We still don't support Watts miners. So we're working on those. So any Watts miner machine can't run BrainsOS Plus.
Really?
So, you know, if there was like a flood, if suddenly a lot of hash rate started using a machine we don't support, then you might see a little drop off in BrainsOS Plus. But I think generally just like all sectors of mining are growing. So I would say it's correlated.
I want to tell people right now, if I go to the Kaboom Racks Telegram chat, so I'm on this whatever marketplace.
You seen the bundle?
Yeah. So
three for 300.
I don't know about that, but look, here's one. Here's an interesting one. Four Bitmain Antminer S19J Pro at 104 terahashes. 19, same model at 100 terahashes. 6 at 96 terahashes. And 1 at 95 terahashes. So what is that total? 30 Antminer S19J Pros. What would you guess that would cost?
30 S19J Pros.
Yeah. Between, I think, what I say, 105 and 90 terahashes? What did I say?
I would say like somewhere between 60 and 90K.
60K, 63K. Yeah, that's good. That ain't a bad deal. $21, $21 what is that metric? A terahash? I forget now.
Yeah,
like that ain't bad, man. Compared to what you were saying at the top of that market, that's another thing the miners, I think, got wrong.
They were selling for 10 grand.
Well, they're selling for 10 grand each. The miners are just as drunk as the rest of us are on the price. And what do? They commit to long-term product procurement contracts with Bitmain and God knows whoever else to get these things for the top of the market price or close, whatever, they get a bulk discount, let's say, or like a vendor discount somehow. And then they got to fulfill those purchase agreements, right? And as those units start coming in, the power is more expensive, the hash rate is higher, like if all the metrics are working against you, and the time to fulfill the order by Bitmain, it never shortened. They were never able to get out in front of that stuff.
I don't know if you remember, Marathon, at the end of last year, Marathon raised $1 billion and bought 199,000 S19 XPs just as they came out. And they were for delivery starting in July 2022. In batches of 12,000 for like six, I can't remember how long, but so they would have just started taking delivery of these machines that they entered into a contract in at the top of the market.
Holy shit, man. I cannot imagine. I would be fucking losing sleep like crazy. I'm going to pull up. I'm going to add to the show window here for people who are watching. You can go over to YouTube to see this, but like this is the Kaboom Racks marketplace. We shared this when we had their CEO on, whose name I forget. I'm terrible with names, but this is the bundle I was talking about right here. Like that ain't bad, man. $21 per terahash includes domestic shipping. So if you're in the States, you get it shipped to you for nothing. How's that? Like that ain't bad, man. If you got the power, if your wife is, you know, if you're either about to get divorced or want to get divorced, that might be a nice way to get that started.
Well, I mean, you were saying earlier, like, I think individual home miners at the moment have a bit more flexibility. They have a couple of things going for them. Most home miners don't rely on the income from their mined Bitcoin to pay for all of their operating costs. Yes, so you were saying you can afford to mine at a loss, perhaps, you know, call it buying Bitcoin at a premium for, you know, for non-KYC purposes or whatever else. But you have income that's not correlated to the Bitcoin price or to your mining operation. So you're kind of, you can subsidize the loss, right? You have cash flow to subsidize the loss. Whereas miners only make revenue from mining. So if their op is going, yeah, it's literally the leverage play. It's like taking out a mortgage, remortgaging your house to pay your mortgage.
I pay my mortgage on my Visa. I don't know about you, but
there is no second best.
Okay, let's get off mining. Let's talk about the I word, our favorite here on the CBP, the inflation number.
Oh, hold on, I have one. Sorry, I did a tiny bit of research before the show. I was trying to read all the core SEC filings. They've just appointed a new director to the board, and guess what his monthly salary is.
$220,000
monthly.
I don't know, what is it?
$35,000
monthly. Yeah, okay,
he's getting paid. Okay. They're going bankrupt and they just hired someone for $35,000 a
year. Is that $220,000 a year? I don't know, it's probably a lot.
That's more. It's like
how many board members do they have? Like, how much are they spending on their board?
I don't know, but that's $300,000. That, like, you have 24 Bitcoin. That's probably like all the Bitcoin gone right there, right? 360K is about 24 Bitcoin.
Pretty close.
They're like, we can afford to pay you. How much Bitcoin do we have on the balance sheet, guys? 24 Bitcoin. 360K a year.
That's what they're talking about over a free sushi lunch that's catered yet again this week over at Coors. I can't believe that.
You know, we laugh, but, you know, these guys are smart. Again, I think we all got, I didn't sell the top, so I can't, you know, I can't go and say to someone, wow, you are so stupid, whatever. Like, okay, I didn't lever mark to market on the asset I was buying and what all that. I don't know, because I have never been in a position either where people are throwing billions of dollars at you and you have a fat bag of equity that you're like, you know, this is going to pump my equity another 50%. And suddenly I go from like 250 million to almost 500 million, or I could become a billionaire. You don't know, there's ego at play. There's all this stuff. There's all these delusions of grandeur. We're all dreaming about what we're going to do when Bitcoin hits $1 million. I'm sure it's the same for all of these guys. So I feel for them, because it's like waking up the next day after a really fun night out and you're hungover and you're like, what did I do last night? What an idiot. I made a fool of myself. And you go into the dark pit.
I am anxious to see, excited is not the right word, anxious might be a better word, to see what becomes of these major miners in the next bull cycle. And one thing I should know, and you mentioned it there, the miners that branched out into other stuff, Hut 8 comes to mind, doing data centers and other stuff like that, you know, Web3, whatever kind of scam they're you know, endorsing over there. But the fact of the matter is, the more revenue streams these guys have, the more unlikely it is that they go belly up during in an environment like we're seeing now. And so, you know, to your point about, I didn't sell the top, so I can't really say much. Look, I think if you're a miner or someone like me who makes content and you know, is publicly critical of these strategies, you got to eat your tongue a little bit here, right? And if you don't, then you're not really admitting that you may have made a mistake and that maybe that strategy was successful after all. I'm not sure what Hut's balance sheet looks like these days. I haven't paid too much attention to what they've been doing, but, you know, presumably they're not in the as poor shape as Coors or Argo are, right? And that's something to consider. Like, I don't know.
From the little I know about Hut 8, they have a lot of operations in Canada and quite a lot of cheap hydropower. So maybe they're not getting stung as much. You know, they got stung with the Bitcoin price and the difficulty, but they're not being stung with the triple, the power price. So I think I remember reading they have like 2 cent power in some areas in Canada. So
that's a snipe. They do have operations here. Anyway, yeah.
And they're not huge either. I don't think they have loads of hash rate.
And there's always the other possibility that as these major miners go offline, a lot of hash rate gets, quote unquote, returned to the Ether. Don't want to talk about that other token at the moment, but you know what I mean. And when that happens, the smaller miners benefit, at least in the short term. It's a bit of a easier situation for them, let's say. So I don't know what's gonna happen with HUT, but my personal view, and I said this last week or 2 weeks ago, I haven't bought any new positions in any of the miners, Bitfarms, Core, Marathon, in more than 8 months, and I don't plan on adding to it anytime soon. I'd rather buy Bitcoin and park money. If I want to buy equities, I'll just park it in the queues or park it in an index fund. I don't feel comfortable picking stocks right now, certainly not in that space. But anyway,
yeah.
So inflation, sir, 10% over in Europe today. I don't know if you saw that. Very interesting stuff. Lots to talk about as far as Christine Lagarde making a public appearance, talking about inflation coming out of nowhere. Over here in North America, Brandon over at the White House today making a short but pointed plea to oil producers to lower the price or suffer the consequences on the tax side of things. Going to levy a windfall tax on oil and gas producers, mentioned specifically Exxon and one other company. I forget which one now. But all this to say that turmoil continuing all over the globe, and inflation seems to be at the core of things. Now, I want to know, since this is your first time talking about inflation on this program, I believe, what are your views as a citizen, as a citizen of, I guess you're in the EU, eh? Are you in the EU?
We're not in the EU. Bitcoin Island is not in the EU. It's in Europe, but it's not in the EU. We're not in the Eurozone. We're not part of the UK. We're not part of the EU. We are a sovereign island floating in the middle of the Irish Sea.
Interesting. I don't even know if that's a real place. I've never been there. I can't point to it on a map either. So do you have a view on things going on in Europe? Do you have a strong opinion on what you've seen from your colleagues in the EU and the Eurozone? And since you're not in the Eurozone, what is the general feeling on Bitcoin Island about all these sorts of things? This seems to me like, a lot of people outside of these countries criticize their policy positions, but you're in a unique spot. You're sort of in the fray, but not quite in the fray. What's going on over there?
I mean, we're not isolated or, shielded from the issues that the rest of Europe, the UK or the EU are going through. We still import gas. The Isle of Man does have a lot of locally produced food and stuff like that, but we still rely on imports. So we're affected by all of it. And the sentiment around here is the same. I mean, I think the populace is getting almost what they deserve, because if there hasn't been a revolution already, and then you have someone like Christine Lagarde come out on television and say that inflation came out of nowhere, and no one bats an eyelid except for Bitcoiners. Nobody says, in normie land, there's no outrage. People don't even understand it. The fact that they're not outraged shows how little they understand, right? That she can just come out and say that and nothing happens. So if that's the case, then you got what you deserve. Because what else can we do? They're not going to save us, and we can't even save ourselves. So we're screwed.
Do you think that there's, speaking as a Canadian, someone who, as much as I try and stay away from mainstream media, I have to consume some to at least help me fill this portrait that I have of what's going on over in Europe. I am constantly told, Gandalf, that the amount of unity that Europeans are willing to show and the amount of sacrifice that, citizens adjacent to the Ukrainian cause are willing to make are a force to be reckoned with, that they will win this war at any cost, this energy war, hot war, cold war, whatever you want to call it. They'll win at any cost, including not heating their homes in the winter, including paying higher prices for all forms of energy, including enduring shortages, including potentially military intervention. They'll go to any stretch. And Concordanomics, who I read sometimes on Substack, had a piece maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago that I think I talked about on the show. I definitely tweeted about it, where they were suggesting that the unity in the UK is like nothing ever before seen. That if any people were equipped to weather this and come out stronger, history tells us it's the people of Europe who are, you know, most well suited to a situation like that. My personal view is that all of the stuff I just said is wrong, sometimes intentionally misleading on the part of the media to try and have people believe this. And that what you're probably more likely to see is that unity fail, and, you know, to put it kindly, over the next 6 weeks, whenever it starts to get cold, basically, is my guess on when you start to see public protests even more than you're seeing now. Do you have the same feeling about the sort of, you know, togetherness that European is showing or not showing? What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's difficult because I don't really speak to non-Bitcoiners that much. So it's difficult to gauge outside of what the mainstream media is telling you about what's going on. I do feel like the general sentiment is very much like there is support for Ukraine and the war, and we must defeat Putin at all costs. And he's not, maybe not all costs, but there is, you know, he's evil. He has to be defeated. He can't get away with this. But I just think perhaps people haven't started to feel the full effects of the higher prices, of higher fuel prices. As you said, winter hasn't started yet. So people can only be pushed so far. You know, if you're hungry enough, you will stop caring about everyone else except for, you know, satiating your hunger. Or if you're freezing to the point where it's, you know, unbearable, you will turn on your gas heating or you'll figure something out. And suddenly you'll stop giving a damn about Ukrainian people or the war or whatever. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that that's what happens, right? If you listen to Yeonmi Park talk about her experiences living in North Korea, one of the ways that the North Korean regime keeps control is that they have the entire populace in such terrible conditions that they can't like think about, oh, we need to overthrow Kim Jong-un or whatever. They're just like thinking about, what am I going to eat next meal? How am I going to keep warm? Where am I going to like find my next set of clean clothes to wear? Or, you know, just basic survival. I don't think we're going to get to that point in Europe. And I think the fact that there hasn't been more uprisings against the war or against, you know, I think people should be looking at ways of like, how can we end the war in the quickest, least painful way? Not how can we go deeper and deeper and deeper into it and try and basically probably push ourselves into a scenario where both, you know, the Russian side and whoever is backing Ukraine end up mutually destroying each other. Because that's where it ends. I listened to an interview. I don't know if you've ever listened to the My First Million podcast. It's a terrible name, but it's a great podcast. They had Palmer Luckey, the founder of Oculus, on. He now runs. He has a defense company. National. So he sells. You know, he helps the U.S. military. Basically, he's a private contractor to the U.S. military. And he made an important point that I hadn't realized, and that is that the U.S. does not have tactical nuclear weapons. The U.S. only has what are called strategic nuclear weapons. So the U.S. strategic nuclear weapon is like a huge nuclear weapon that can blow up a city or whatever, whereas like a tactical nuke is smaller and you can like use it to, I guess, like target an airfield or maybe like a small village or like some specific small location. And so, but in the media and in terms of like the power struggle, a nuke is a nuke, right? When you hear Russia might use tactical nukes, we don't know the distinction between strategic and tactical. For us and for probably a lot of people, it's, oh, they use a nuke, so now we're going to have to use a nuke or there's going to be nuclear war or whatever. The other thing is that, so if he says that he thinks it's likely that Russia will use a tactical nuke, because, you know, let's say they blow up an airfield with a tactical nuke or some other location, right? Then the U.S. is left in a spot. The game theory is like, if the U.S. does nothing, then they're signaling to other powers like China that, hey, you can come in here, you can trample all over us, you can use tactical nukes, and we can't respond because we only have strategic nukes. I mean, if we use a strategic nuke, all hell breaks loose, right? We can't respond like for like with a tactical nuke. We have to escalate to respond with a nuclear weapon. So he thinks it's inevitable. He basically thinks it's impossible that Russia uses a tactical nuke and that the US does not respond with a strategic nuke.
Wow. I didn't know that. So that you're telling me that this guy is going on podcasts making that distinction, and I have not heard this. That's really something to think about, because
he talked about Bitcoin as well in the same pod. He was like,
he's a Bitcoin guy. You know that he's got also longstanding beef with Jason Calacanis from All In. Yeah.
I don't know what the beef is, but I know that they had beef. He went to the All In summit and then they called him out on stage, right?
That's right. Yeah. Outstanding. Yeah. I didn't know that Palmer Luckey did that podcast. So I'm going to go listen to it. I do like him. The military angle, I almost don't even want to call it that because it almost downplays the significance of what's going on over there. Obviously terrible. But the military angle is to me, at the moment anyway, the least significant piece of that conflict. As someone who's not involved directly, doesn't have, you know, hail of shells raining down on my town or my neighborhood.
Yeah.
What I think is, when I look at that conflict, there's so many cards being turned over that just have nothing on the other side that we've been told for so long were aces in the hole or strong points for modern democracies, U.S. military points of interest, European military points of interest, modern economics. All these things completely upended, starting with, you know, the sort of financial engineering that drives wealth in the first world. Turns out it's all backed by cheap commodities, you know, especially in the German instance, where Germany produces, you know, close to $1 trillion worth of products and services per year on the back of about $100 billion in cheap Russian energy. Yeah. So like, if you think about that turnaround and that ratio, that sort of return on investment, you can't get that anywhere else. And I think a lot of people took that for granted. That's one thing. The other thing that I'm really upset about, and we can talk about this next if you have a view, is Canada, of all countries, seems to be the only place now where elected and appointed officials alike are talking about nuclear power becoming a bigger part of the grid mix. I cannot for the life of me understand how more countries are not doing this. And it is extremely frustrating to me to watch this happen. I'm lucky that in Ontario, here in Canada, we're one of the best grid mixes on the planet. I think we're about 70% nuclear and 30% other sources. And that took a long time for us to kind of, you know, for us to get through to the public. Obviously, public opinion when it comes to nuclear is, you know, it leaves something to be desired most of the time. But I look at Europe, Germany, you know, saying they're going to extend the life of some power plants, but not really talking about building new nuclear. In the States, they refuse to mine uranium. And instead would have, you know, other countries mine nickel, cobalt, other sort of battery related nonsense. It's never going to work as a sustainable power source. Do you have a view on this, Gandalf? Like what is your take on the sort of nuclear, anti-nuclear madness coming out of Europe these days?
Yeah, I think as you described it perfectly, it does seem like madness. I don't, you know, I'm by no means like an energy expert or a nuclear expert. I just know about it through what I've read and learned from studying Bitcoin mining and how that, you know, pulls you into the grid. And then it just so happens, obviously, like energy and electricity is just a big hot topic in mainstream media as well. But nuclear seems to be the answer for now and the future. So, you know, these countries should not be turning off nuclear power plants at this point in time. It just seems like it's almost criminal. I mean, I would argue that it's criminal. I would argue that it's treason to, because people have been done for treason for lesser things, at least things that have had less of an impact on a real impact on their countries. They've been done for treason, you know, Edward Snowden or Julian Assange, done for revealing illegal spy programs by, you know, nations on their own people, or war crimes, right? The US looks bad that it's committed a war crime, but nothing really bad has happened to the US as a result of that, right? But look at something like Germany. These politicians relying on Russian gas have put Germany in a terrible place, right? I would argue that's more treasonous than anything that any of these other people I've mentioned have done. But how could you put your national, it's a matter of national security. It's just gross negligence in terms of from a national security perspective. And I just don't, and then switching off the nuclear power plants, it's like a comedy of errors.
Doomberg calls it the law of anti-logic, where you can count on world leaders when it comes time to make a decision, making the worst possible decision 100% of the time. It's almost, you know, you can set your watch by it, which sucks. You know, that's world now, right? That seems to be the case all over the place.
Yeah. These jobs are arguably the leaders of countries are arguably amongst the most powerful people on earth. These should be positions and roles that people are clamoring to fill. It should be the finest, smartest, most hardworking, honest humans wanting to get to these positions so they can do right by their, you know, their countries, their societies, their fellow man. Yet for whatever reason, you have Rishi Sunak, who's now PM of the UK by literal accident. Like, the person he ran against beat him, then resigned, and then nobody else could be bothered to run again in the next leadership race. And so now he's the PM just by default. And I've already read articles today that about Tory MPs preparing a vote of no confidence against him because he shook up the cabinet too much. And him and the Chancellor coming out and saying that it's inevitable that British people will have to pay more taxes. It's a joke. Like, they've literally gone from someone who's like, I'm going to cut taxes to try and spur on growth, to someone who is like, he wants to bring back austerity measures at a time where inflation is super high and energy costs are super high. And he's going to make you pay more taxes out of the money that he's handing out to you.
That's the best.
It doesn't even make any sense.
That's the best part, is that the taxes are like, the cost of administering a tax regime in this way is incredibly stupid. Okay. Like you mentioned there, the stimmies come in one form or another, whether it's a subsidy for your energy here in Ontario. I don't know if you've heard about this subsidy. We just had a subsidy released last week from our premier. So not even our federal government, but our Ontario government we have standardized testing here for grades 3, 6, 9, and 10. It's math, English, and I think that's it. And then the core competencies in grade 9 and 10 are strictly math, strictly English. While the grade 3 and 6 tests are both. And the results have been poor the last few years. Even before COVID, they were poor. The teachers in this province suck, but that's a story for another time. The problem that the government is trying to solve now, Gandalf, with $250 checks per kid for each family. They're calling it the math subsidy. You can use it to get tutoring for your kids. All the fucking price of everything soars. Everyone's just using it to buy Tostitos, man. Like, it's honestly hilarious that people are like, oh, Ford government, God bless them, you know, for giving out these checks. I actually wanted to get Doug Ford on the show, so I can't let him hear that part of the segment. But it's wild, man, how many different subsidy programs are coming out. And then to your point, the government's just paying someone at the federal level to claw it back via taxes. Like, yeah. What are we talking about? If you're going to claw it back, just keep it. Why are we doing this? What's happening?
It is like a circle jerk, isn't it? But the other crazy thing is, like, how much more taxes can people pay? Like, the highest tax bracket in the UK is 45%. And then you add national insurance on top of that, which is like a social security payment. And then, you know, a quarter of a fifth of every pound you spend is in sales tax, and then you're paying council tax. And then if you know, God forbid you make some money on a stock, capital gains tax.
Or your house, even. Are you guys paying taxes? I say you guys, but are Brits primary, paying taxes on primary or no?
On your primary residence, you do not pay capital gains. I'm not sure if there's a cap up to a set, like if the house is worth a certain amount, you don't pay anything. Right. But yeah. I smash sold the top of the UK housing bubble literally just before Boris Johnson resigned and Liz Truss got in is when I sold.
That's incredible. Good for you. Sell on your house. Incredible stuff. It's so liquid a market. You can just smash sell in Canada. Dude,
I had I had like two or three viewings and an offer that was almost 10% over the asking, I think. Can't 10% remember,
is,
but
10% is low, buddy. That's low over here. You got to shoot
over
20%
there.
Here.
Over there is decent. I live in, you know, Stirling in Scotland. Not a hot spot.
That's right, I guess. In Canada, you know that the federal government here has spent, Mike Campbell, who we had on a little while ago, talks about this on his show sometimes. There's been a lot of research done with federal tax money on implementing a capital gains program on primary resident sales in Canada. So I think soon, probably, you're going to either pay unrealized gains at some small percentage on the value of your home, or you're going to pay capital gains on the sale of your primary residence, which in both cases would just be completely fucking insane. Complete nonsense, third world banana republic stuff.
I mean, but I think we're probably close. Isn't a property tax already a sort of unrealized gains?
Oh yeah, by the way,
right?
You're not paying on market value, but they dictate the percentage of the appraised value. So the appraised value over here, they call it MPAC. It's a municipal property assessment something. Someone can tell me what that C stands for in the chat if you're from Ontario. And what they do is they come around and evaluate the property value of your home. The problem is, if you own your home for a long time, that value kind of creeps up slowly. It's manageable, right? But if you buy and sell your home, if you're the new buyer, the property value will reflect the price you paid. And so that tax really moves up as the velocity of the market increases. And it's a disaster, right? If you're a first-time home buyer now who just bought a house, your home is worth significantly less than when you bought it. Do you think MPAC, the assessment people come around and say, why don't you pay less in property taxes? Absolutely fucking not, buddy. They never come around with that message. They're never going to. It's never going to happen. So you're paying more in taxes.
You've seen what happens when somebody tries to lower taxes, Liz Truss. She's lasted 45 days.
You're out of here, buddy. You're out of here. Okay, let's move to the Bitcoiner and no coiner of the week. And even though my co-host is not here, we have to talk about the person and the company who sponsors this. Gandalf, have you seen this graphic before, sir? Sponsored by Tahini's Mediterranean Cuisine. Are you ready for this tagline? I made this up on my own one time on the fly. No matter what the price is, it's always a bull market at Tahini's restaurants. Do you like that? Nice. Soundboard. We got to add some production value to this program. All we have is graphics and that whatever intro Len paid for. So I don't have a Bitcoiner of the week. I have a no coiner of the week. And then if you got one or the other, you can go into yours. My no coiner of the week, as we talked about earlier, is Christine Lagarde, Skeletor herself, getting on public airwaves and talking about where inflation came from. Now, there's no mention from Ms. Lagarde about the quantitative easing, about the COVID programming, about the other inflationary pressures her regime at the European Central Bank have not only, I think, you know, run with, but in some respects pioneered this sort of, you know, running support programs while also combating inflation in certain parts of the European Union. For her to get on TV and talk about how there's no way anyone could have seen this coming and came out of nowhere. Gandalf, you made a great point earlier, one that I've made on the show many times, that the normies who don't know what the problem with that is are the ones who need to know the most. They're the ones who are being cheated out of the most. They're the most financially illiterate. And it's not their own fault. It's they're existing in a world where to just make ends meet with a family, you need to have a certain level of financial literacy and financial competence and income. And those three things together are very hard to come by these days, especially if you're just getting started. And to me, one of the biggest sort of tragedies, travesties of the monetary regime, you know, modern day monetary regime, is that the busyness of day-to-day life for these people and the lack of understanding that causes leads to friction in their personal lives, their professional lives, their romantic lives. I think I've said this before, it's going to destroy families. It's going to cause kids to have poorer upbringings than they should. And none of that shit is fair. While this lady gets on TV with a new pashmina every goddamn week and makes up some bullshit about how she fucked things up and doesn't want to take blame for it. So Christine Lagarde, my no coiner of the week.
And also a reminder, she is a convicted criminal.
A convicted criminal. Yes. Yes.
I'm pretty sure what she got convicted of was not a civil charge, but a criminal charge, but received no jail time or got a suspended sentence or just got fined or something. When she was the head of the IMF.
Very interesting. How about that?
Yeah, I think she was the French finance minister when she committed the crime, but she got a sentence when she was the head of the IMF. And now she's the head of the European Central Bank. So she's just doing the rounds. She's going from like head to slightly better head to now the biggest head.
you really could have followed through with a great joke there, but I'm glad you didn't because this is a family show. Do you have a no coiner or Bitcoiner of the week?
I'll go with the two people or a group of people for Bitcoiners of the week and a single person for No Coiner of the week from my conference attendances. So for Bitcoiners of the week, I'd give it to, and they are my friends, so I'm being a little biased. Joe Hull, the reporter from Cointelegraph, he's their resident Bitcoin maximalist. He's fighting the shit coiners all day long at his job online. The guy hustles, he's everywhere, and he's amazing. He emceed the Edinburgh conference. He was on the panel for Bitcoin's media problem in Amsterdam, and he's just an all-around nice guy. Hopefully you get to meet him one day. But him and then Carla and Walker, the crypto couple or the BTC couple, they emceed Lugano. I've gotten to know them over this year as well. They're both amazing humans, amazing Bitcoiners, and their videos are funny as hell. So they're my Bitcoiners of the week. They're rising. Their stars will rise, unlike some people. And my No Coiner of the week is Jemima Kelly, the Financial Times columnist who writes about Bitcoin, who claims she understands Bitcoin because she's been writing about it for the Financial Times since 2015. And when Daniel Prince, the moderator of the panel, asked Rizzo, Joe Hull, the other lady, Isabella, that's an ex-FT journalist, and Jemima, he asked them all a question, and he said, who here has written a Bitcoin FUD article? Raise your hand. And Rizzo and Joe put their hands up, and the two mainstream media journalists did not put their hands up because they said that their articles about criticizing Bitcoin are legitimate, fair criticism.
The self-important pricks in the media,
oh,
buddy.
Oh, God.
The worst.
Legitimate and fair criticisms of Bitcoin, and they understand it.
Unfucking believable. Good pick. That's a really good pick. A lot of people in the chat saying that they're happy you came prepared with one of each and we should make all the guests give a No-Coiner and Bitcoiner of the week. I don't know. Maybe that's not a bad idea.
I didn't even come prepared. I forgot that we do this. Your shows are on so late. I usually catch like 10 minutes or 15 minutes here and there when I'm in bed, like trying to pass out. I say, send a couple of messages.
We appreciate it. Gandalf, we're going to go to the after show. Do you want to tell people who don't make it to YouTube where they can find out more about you, more about Brains? It's only fair that I give you a chance to hand off.
Yeah, just follow me on Twitter. That's the best place to see. I'm always tweeting, so that's the best place to see what I'm up to. If you want to check out Brains, that's just Brains with two eyes representing one. Each eye represents one of our co-founders. Brains with two eyes, and then thefamous.com.
I didn't know that. That's not really that cool. I liked it better when it was just stylized. But anyway, okay. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Thanks for Gandalf for co-hosting. We appreciate him. We're going to go to the after show. We'll spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes with the chat, and then we'll talk to you guys when we talk to you. Take care of yourselves till then.
Thanks for having me.
You got to say take care.
Take care.